My name is John Schramm, and this is the first of three sessions on orders in the history of the church, and testing the premise of whether or not orders might be a form of church renewal that is needed today. To a certain extent, this session started some years ago in my thinking and in a minor way in my life, and probably started, if there was one point where it started, it was a quote from John V. Taylor in a book called Enough is Enough, and I will share that quote with you. It is not difficult to see that swimming against the tide of an affluent consumer society and defying its pressures is going to entail sacrifice. We must avoid self-dramatization and keep a strong sense of humor. We should not take ourselves too seriously, but should take Christ much more seriously. We badly need the devotion of the very first monks, the desert fathers who staged their dramatic dropout from a world in which the inflationary consumer society of the later Roman Empire concluded its first official alliance with the formerly outlawed Christian community and so brought the counterculture into the establishment. Monasticism then became the lifestyle of the protest. I believe that the impasse of our global economic imbalance calls for a new kind of monastic movement, which will be secular, non-celibate, and non-institutional. When Bishop Taylor calls for a new monastic movement, or calls for monks, or an order of monks, the question, first of all, is whether or not he's using the correct term. Yes.
What page is that on?
I think it's page 80 of Enough is Enough, published by Augsburg. Yeah, I think it's page 80, Spence. Is that the correct term? Is that what he meant to say, a new order of monks? Let's look at what the word monk or monastery means, first of all, and then some historic reference to monasticism and holy orders, and then test whether or not the bishop is using that word advisedly. Monastic or monastery comes from a Greek word, monachos, M-O-N-A-C-H-O-S, very similar to the Latin word solus, and it has to do with being alone. So if one of your first free associations was solitude, that certainly is where the word itself came from that describes the kind of movements we're going to be studying. Very often, the first monastic movements did come as protest, as Bishop Taylor says, when they went into the desert. They were the protest movement. It seems to me if there is one characteristic, and we're going to come back and test this later, if there's one characteristic more than any other, it's this protest against, and often it was against a consumer society or materialism. Very often, the first people to go out into the desert or to drop out or to protest used the words or responded to the words, go sell all that you have, give to the poor, come and follow me. That was true of St. Anthony. That was true of, to a certain extent, St. Francis in a vision. So that that will be a key part of what we see today. The monks were of two kinds. The first word, I'm sure that is a familiar one to you. The second one may not be. There were two kinds. The hermits lived alone so that their solitary life was literally to be in a little cave in the desert. But there were cenobites, C-E-N-O-B-I-T-E-S. Those were the monks or the hermits who lived in community. And it early took both forms. There your solitude was being alone together. In other words, you respected one another's silence and other things, but it was a form of communal living. You probably can't talk about orders until St. Augustine, or Augustine, it depends upon where you are, how that's pronounced. We know who we mean. But there were some things that happened before what you could call an order. So let me now give you some history. Probably the key person in the East was St. Basil or St. Anthony. This is 3rd century, and there were hermits, including Martin of Tours, in the West, but probably until St. Augustine, had communities of people, you can't really talk about orders. St. Augustine had some of the first guidelines for living together. Again, it was a protest movement that he led, different radically and deliberately in its way of life from the culture around it. There were three characteristics of these first Augustinian communities: flee from the world, abandon your possessions, and have some kind of rule for a common life. And this was the oldest in the Western Church, was what St. Augustine wrote to some of these communities. But it was not flee from the world in order to have no contact with the world. It was flee from the world in order to then be a protest movement that faced the world in your common life. It was not solitude for the sake of retreat. It was, in the language we were using, a protest movement. Let me give you a little bit about the rule of St. Augustine so that you have some sense of these different rules. The Augustinians sought in an informal and unassuming way to live a communal life devoted to fulfilling ordinary local needs. They really didn't flourish until the 12th century as far as becoming a primary factor in their culture. They based their idea primarily of an order on a letter that St. Augustine wrote to a group of women in which he considered how they could live together. His advice is much simpler than the rule of St. Benedict. They should own, this is really the Augustinian rule in a very condensed form. They should own everything in common, pray together at specific times, dress in the same way, and obey a superior. Augustine's letter was attractive because it provided a link with the early church and because it was so simple and flexible. Probably the key person in all of monasticism is St. Benedict of Nursia. You're talking about the year 530. If you are with a Benedictine or see somebody who signs OSB after their name, Order of St. Benedict, this is not a centralized institution. We will get to some characteristics that differ. The most centralized by far on the board are the Jesuits. When we get there, you'll find that they are different in almost every way. One of the reasons I put them up here is so that you have some freedom to say, well, there's not just one definition, look at the Jesuits. Or it doesn't have to be cenobitic or hermits, look at, you'll find a lot of variety on the board. But St. Benedict tried to establish a way in which his rule, yes?
What do you mean by centralized?
Centralized authority, meaning one organization with branches rather than communities that link together somehow but are not, they don't have one hierarchical superior with all of the things underneath them. There is a superior general of the Jesuits, and all Jesuits give obedience to that head. Benedictines have independent houses under their own abbot, and they are linked together through the rule of St. Benedict, but there's no central authority over all of them. You see, they are much more linked by a rule that has a preface and 73 parts to it, and calls for moderation, and those houses differ from one another quite a bit, but they're brought together by the rule of St. Benedict. Have you read Rule of Tezay? Have you read Rule for a New Brother? Do you know it kind of orders your life? It gives you a guideline, a standard that you bounce up against. Well, the Rule of St. Benedict is the most substantive or basic rule of all of monasticism, has been since 530 or 540. Most other rules are somewhat similar or have that as the primary source. Is that a way to say it? Okay. Other questions? Just interrupt the flow at any point. Okay. He envisioned a family under an abbot. I'm going to give you some of the differences. Benedictines, at the beginning anyway, gave a vow of stability. Have you ever heard that as one of the vows? Do you know what that means? That your vow was not only, what are the three historic vows that you think of? They're in Metz's book too. Poverty, celibacy, and obedience. Stability was a Benedictine vow that when you made your profession, You stayed in place. You stayed at that monastery for the rest of your life. You were not, let me give you another word, a mendicant that traveled and begged. You were stable. You had one location for life. That was a distinctive part of Benedictine. He also had the three other more traditional vows. Started as a lay order. I want to give you that as input too. Most of the early orders, I guess all of the early orders, started with lay people. You don't get to primarily clergy until you get to the Dominicans, and you don't get to exclusively clergy until you get to the Jesuits. They now bring in some lay brothers, but it started as a clergy order. The Dominicans, do you know what OP stands for? Why you get OP after Dominican? It's the order of the friar preachers. It was an order that had as its primary function preaching. But in the Benedictines and in the Franciscans, you started with lay people. When you have these five on the board, you have the primary orders. In the Benedictines, I went to two others because they may be familiar to you, and they were offshoots, and it shows you a little bit how some of these things developed. Saint Bernard of Clairvaux was a Cistercian. That was a form of Benedictines, and usually a reform movement is why you have a new branch. Somebody who says, we are not keeping the original fervor, and so you have a new order that tries to bring back some of that original enthusiasm, the Cistercian order. There was one Cistercian, Jean Le Boutelaire de Rancay. I assume de Rancay means the town he was from. Is that right? Is that the way you say it? He, not dissimilar from many people of his time, was ordained and was not especially faithful, religious, or moral. Maybe that hasn't changed completely, but I think it was more assumed that it could happen in that time without anybody even frowning. I think today at least there's a frown. But it was said of him that he preached like an angel in the morning and lived like a devil at night, if you want some characterization of this man. He had a tremendous shock come in the form of the death of his mistress, and it caused the kind of conversion that sometimes happens. And not only did he become a priest then with integrity and with fervor, but became a Cistercian, was assigned to be the abbot at La Trappe, T-R-A-P-P-E, and his order was even the Cistercians of the strict observance, meaning the Trappists. So if you've ever heard of a Trappist monk, Thomas Merton was one. This may be the strictest of everything on the board, and what was fun in the study was to get out of all of the kind of history material and get stories about how some of those things started. But anyway, Jean La Boutelaire de Rancay. Jean, J-E-A-N, Jean. He was originally a priest that was ordained probably by purchasing some ordination or something. I mean, he was a nobleman and a playboy. After the shock and the conversion, went into a Cistercian order and was made an abbot of a particular Cistercian monastery at La Trappe, and they took on the distinctive Cistercians of the strictest observance, I think is Cistercians of the strict observance. That's what Trappists are. But the name Trappist came because of that particular monastery. Like Carmelite came because of Mount Carmel, which was the first monastery of that order. And then Saint Teresa of Avila and Brother Lawrence and other people of that order continued that name with some distinctiveness, but they flow from these general basic rules or orders. Yes, Jamie. Very similar to today. You were either ordained a priest, that would be clergy, or were a lay person, member of the church, but not theologically trained or ordained. I mean, there was a form of laying on of hands, setting apart for a particular function. And it may be an oversimplification, but the priest would be word and sacrament, preach or administer the sacraments. Or in a monastery, the difference would be the choir monks who said holy office and whose primary function was worship as against lay brothers or lay order who did the work in the fields or crafts or horticulture or food preparation. So within the monastery, the distinction would be between those whose primary function was prayer and worship and those whose primary function was physical work. Okay? Other questions? Benedictines, Augustinians, Dominicans, Franciscans all also had, almost from the start, orders for women and third order, meaning lay people who kept their family, kept their job, but observed some daily discipline consistent with the rule of the monks or the nuns who were members of the order. The first time you have an order that doesn't have any possibility of third order or women is the Jesuits. They have a very different reason for organizing, so we'll get down to that. There are a lot of people who would draw the line under Dominican and not even have Jesuits part of an order. When Sister Maria Augusta Neal was here this summer, I don't know that she can prove it from history, but she certainly has some substantiation in history, and you have some substantiation in the Book of Acts. It may well be that the first orders were women, and the orders were their way of becoming part of the church and grouping together in a church that was so heavily patriarchal and male. It may be that it started not only with lay people, excluded always throughout history in some ways by clericalism. If you, Jamie, you would know what clericalism is, would you not, if I said what clerical was? It would be domination by those or special status to those who are preachers or clerics over against more ordinary or people who don't quite make it. Whenever you have first class and second class citizens, which you sometimes do in a church, preachers and the rest, or, well, it was also, if you had clericalism, you also had a kind of paternalistic or male domination, and so it may have been that some of the impetus for the first orders in the church were women. I want to go a little bit more into the rule of Saint Benedict rather than just the Benedictine order itself. I guess the primary thing that you think of when you think of Benedictine is balance, harmony, wholeness, moderation. I didn't know what she meant when Sister Maria Augusta Neal this summer said, as soon as I stepped off the bus and had a one day's experience at Holden, I said, oh, Benedictine style. That's a great compliment. This is what she meant. I said, Benedictine style, I've never even heard the term. And she said, well, the component parts, a balance of worship and work, with a kind of high priority on the fun of work, of it being a natural part of a rhythm of life, starting the day and ending the day, matins and vespers, singing, a lot of when the Lutheran hymnal is Benedictine style of everybody involved in the singing, a kind of balance of serious and play. The room, almost every room has at least one piece of art rather than austere and without beauty. And most of the time, she said, it looks like someone here made it. It's ceramic or it's fabric art or it's painting. It isn't manufactured and brought in like Holiday Inn and they mass produce some piece. It came from the community's life. Those are the kinds of things she answered as far as Benedictine style. The waking hours in a Benedictine monastery were divided into just about three equal parts: prayer in common, reading and study, and manual work. And the manual work was divided into the domestic work necessary, crafts, and the horticulture. It was a It was a self-contained economic unit, a Benedictine monastery, and that's another thing that she saw at Holden. Compost, our own hydro, labor-intensive work. If we could also grow our own food here, which we can't, if we had fields to bring our own food so that we were really a complete economic unit, that would be Benedictine style. And who said music? Benedictines are the ones about that developed the choral chanting. There's a great quote about Benedictine style of singing. Monotony so sublime that it grips the soul. Maybe you either really like Benedictine chanting or you don't, but it does have a very distinctive way of doing the canonical office. Another thing that I think is important, which a lot of you mentioned in your free association, and that is a robe. I think you ought to know that the early Benedictines did wear the robe that is now, the distinction is whether or not it's brown with white or brown with black cincture or sandals or something else, or what kind of cowl, or Dominicans are white with black cowl, what have you. When the Benedictines dressed that way, they were indistinguishable from the poor who wore those kinds of robes. It was not distinctive garb at the time it started. It's distinctive because they kept it when the dress of everyone else, poor or rich, changed. But I think some of those things are important in the history. So they did not try to look different. They took the robe of that which would be the common people of that day. And for Pat Hayden, distinctive Benedictine style is hospitality. The quote from St. Benedict of the rule is, "Let all guests be received like Christ." Okay, Franciscan. Let me share a little bit about St. Benedict from the same thing where I shared the Augustinian order. As opposed to the individualistic heroics of desert monks like Anthony, Benedict's rule is a rule for beginners. The life most conducive to obedience to God is one lived in common and in moderation. When we read the rule today, it may seem harsh, early rising, spare menus, but when it was written, it provided a reasonable and a secure life in an otherwise very unstable world. It establishes a very structured day which is defined by frequent intervals of corporate worship. It describes the duties necessary for operating a community which is as self-contained as possible. Benedict did not perceive his community as a means of infusing order into society as a whole. He sought simply to provide ordinary people with a structured communal alternative to a particularly chaotic society. When you get to Francis, you have a somewhat different thing. You don't know much about the life of St. Benedict. You know his rule. You don't know an awful lot about the rule of St. Francis, you know an awful lot about his life, and that is one of the differences. St. Francis is by his own charisma, it is a distinctive order. It's called a seraphic spirituality, S-E-R-A-P-H-I-C, because it emphasizes the love of God, and is centered so much on the principle of love and not so much on a rule with 73 parts to it. I don't think we have to go into a lot of the life of St. Francis. If you were here last year, I guess none of you were except maybe Janet and Mary. Dan Erlander did a lot in the year of St. Francis. It's on tapes. A troubadour, your picture of gloom and no happiness and what have you. Study St. Francis, my goodness. And the conversion and throwing all of the garments that his father was fairly wealthy, throwing goods out of a tower to poor people, taking off all of his clothes in the middle of the square, the conversion that came with hearing a crucifix speak to him and saying, "Rebuild my church," and St. Francis assuming that the vision was to rebuild that particular building, so that's what he did. Stone by stone. Later, obviously, it was also rebuild my church, meaning all of the body of Christ in such a state of need for renewal. He and the other brothers minor, and here most people do know this was a lay order. I'm not sure most people know that Most of the orders started with lay people, but they do know Order of Friars Minor was a group of lay people. Went and asked for the Pope to recognize their order, OFM, Orders of Friars Minor, and the Pope, disgusted with the way they looked and smelled, or illiterate and uncouth, or whatever the word said, seems to me that what you're fit for is to feed the pigs, and dismiss them. And Francis came back the next day and said, we have done that, which they did for 24 hours, was feed pigs. Now what, Your Holiness? But the key thing was, one of the advisors of the Pope said, if we do not recognize them, do we not publicly say that you cannot live the way our Lord said to live? Would we not publicly say to everybody, we really do not believe Jesus? In other words, one advisor said, we're stuck. He's taking literally those words of the one we say is Lord of the universe. So the orders of Friar Minor were recognized. Pardon, yes. Okay, St. Benedict was five. Let me put those up. St. Benedict, 530 to 540. They're not positive on the. Let's put 530. Then there's a long period until St. Francis. St. Francis is 1182 to 1226 is his life. Let's make it 1200. Okay. I'll get to Dominicans were 1215 created as a permanent order, very similar. And the Jesuits, the last one on the board, were 1534. And you understand, a lot of things emerged. St. Augustine was very early, fourth century? Yeah. What, do you have a date? I don't think I had a date for that. The orders scattered, had little differences when people took the Benedictine rule, but had their own distinctive mark to it in some other country. So we're taking what almost everything I read said were the major parts from which everything else has branched out. Okay? Is that... We could have free associated on St. Francis. His bride was poverty. All creatures were brothers and sisters. Don't you know enough of the story and the beauty of St. Francis? All right, that's been a very important part of the monastic movement. By 1221, there were 3,000 friars who came to a convocation of the order. It grew very rapidly. The final part of St. Francis's conversion was Matthew 10, 7 through 13, he heard read at a mass. I think if I give you a few of the words, you know the general section. Preach as you go, say the kingdom of heaven is at hand, heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons. You've been given without pay, serve without pay, do not take gold, silver, sandals, two tunics, whatever. And he said that's it, and that was the way he lived the rest of his life. Again, took very literally the words of Jesus. Some of the women's orders that become part of the Franciscan style, Poor Clares, Bernardine Sisters, Capuchinus, and Felician Sisters. All of those also have the titles, the letters that go after them. I want to come back to it being primarily a protest movement. And that is a quote from St. Francis. The Lord said to me that he desired me to be a new simpleton in this world and that he would not lead me by any other way. We have to move a little more quickly or I'm not going to get to the major essence in question for the day. Dominicans. St. Dominic, OP, means the orders of friar preachers. Up until now, all the monastic orders had started as lay foundations, had only gradually become clerical communities. But Dominic said that they needed priests to carry out a plan, and so he needed an order of preachers. consistent with Metz's, with many times in Metz's book, St. Dominic said the preaching best calculated to move a secularized Christian community is, an example, the preaching most effective is to live or to follow Christ. So that an order of preachers, not because he sharpened homiletics classes, but because he said the only way you really preach is congruency and have your life line up with what you're saying. So the order again came into a church where the words were one thing, but the life often of the people who were saying the words was not really following Christ. So the Dominicans were a strong factor within the renewal of the church, especially through preaching and preaching by example.
John, where did Dominic live?
I don't have it. I'd have to look it up. I didn't write it in my notes. Yeah, I think they did, but I'd have to look it up, Spence. Sorry. I put 1215 as the date.
Yeah.
Okay. They had the three historic vows. They did have the chanting of the divine office. You know what that means at this point? Keeping, there are seven, you experience matins, vespers, and compline. Those are three of the 7 hours that were kept in a typical monastery. Holden is Benedictine style, so that we do not get you up at 2:45 in the morning for the first office. If you go to a Cistercian or a Trappist monastery, you get up at 3 as the first one. And there are some during the day, I'm not sure I know the hours, one's at noon. Vespers is kind of late afternoon, not after supper. Prime, terse. Matins and Lauds is together, usually. And I think Matins is quite early in the morning. Anyway, there were 7 offices during the day when the monks came into the chapel and worshipped. And the Dominicans had that chanting. And community life was also part of the Dominicans. There are some very famous Dominicans. St. Thomas Aquinas, probably the most famous for the theological writing that he did. And the Dominicans bring in a very strong strand of mysticism. Meister Eckhart. Read some Meister Eckhart sometime if you've never done that. Johannes Tauler, Catherine of Siena, and at least one famous painter, Fra Angelico. So you have a kind of incongruency in Dominicans. Strong commitment to example, beautiful strands of mysticism. Some of the early pre-Reformation, Savonarola was a forerunner of Luther by calling for reform, but you also have the Dominicans, the primary instruments for the Inquisition. Just a strange tension of how an order could be known for such fine things and also be the one you think of when you think of the Inquisition. Okay. Yep. Oh, heavy emphasis on preaching also then meant a heavy emphasis on getting rid of heresy, of not only preaching meaning a proclamation of the gospel, but preaching meaning custodians of orthodoxy. And so if there was somebody who wasn't preaching truth, it doesn't take long in a fallen world that you not only try to dialogue, but you try to make them, force them into truth.
The Inquisition didn't start out with all kinds of torture and awful stuff,
no,
right?
No, was, correct.
I mean, it was like trying to reform.
Yeah, it isn't that unlikely to think of them as helping in the first part of spreading truth. So I don't know that you can blame the Dominicans for how the Inquisition turned, but...
Was the Meister Eckhart kicked out of the Dominican?
Oh, no, I don't think so. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, Society of Jesus. I'm going to do this very quickly. I put it up here for a couple reasons. A Dominican, Father Soto, maintained that without the observance of the monastic rule, which they do not really have, a congregation could not be a religious order. so that there is some disagreement of whether or not you put the line here or the Jesuits are an order. One of the reasons that you can say they are an order is, on the contrary, this is the answer back to Father Soto, on the contrary, if there has ever been a real order, it's the Society of Jesus. It's characterized most by a unique sense of membership, esprit de corps. So when you say order, you can mean some historic characteristics, or you can say a kind of oneness of purpose. And if that's what you mean by order, then the Jesuits are the best example on the board. I go into that only because one of the things I want to do this first morning is to shatter an easy definition of what an order is. You simply have too much variety up here to have an easy answer to that. Let me tell you how Jesuits are distinctive from the other things on the board and are still called an order. Highly centralized, the others really are not. Probation of several years before final vows, harder to get in. It's the longest formal education of any, I think, Christian group, is it not? I mean, it's a long, long time. Yeah, okay. They are really well trained, I'll tell you. Instead of the... how long? I think if you count... You mean if you start with first grade? I had 20 years, and I think they have 27. Is that right?
It's I had my friend in seminary was contemplating on entering the Jesuits after he finished seminary. It would have been, I think, 8 more years before.
Okay, 8 more.
So that was
uh-huh.
After seminary.
You don't have to be a Jesuit, Janet. I mean, that's right. It's the only one that says you. There's not even an order for you. There's not even an auxiliary. All right. I don't mean to put the Jesuits down. They are very distinctive. Instead of the choral singing of the Holy Office, they did it privately. Instead of corporate worship with the chanting that you think of as monastic, they recited their own divine office. No cloisters. Absence of obligatory fasts or penance. The dress is not the dress of ordinary people, nor is it a distinctive garb. They chose to dress the way the clergy of that diocese dress. It started as a clergy order, it is still a clergy order, and you can't tell them from a parish priest. It's usually the backward collar, and I mean, there's no distinctive garb, but nor is it the garb of ordinary people or the poor people. It's the garb of a secular priest. That's maybe a strange term. No female branch, no third order, no change of name when you take your vows. In the other orders, you took on a Benedictine name or a Dominican name or a Franciscan. Instead of John, you became something else. Yes, Jamie. In the other orders, those people who took vows of celibacy, poverty, obedience, or stability to be in that order for the rest of the time and what have you, and had a rule, those were what you thought of as the monks. But they all had ways in which people kept a family life and a job and lived in a home, but kept like a daily discipline of a divine office, and so that they were third order. It does give a gradation to it, but it also said what we're doing can be done by other people in their own way. It was not a put-down to be third-order Franciscan. It was a way in which lay people were included in the, I'm going to use a Metz phrase, that the orders are to be contagious, a contagious lead in the church, intimidation, but an encouragement. A contagious thing. Well, the Jesuits did not build in a way in which it could be contagious by being third order Jesuit. That's all I'm saying. But they had a particular function. They were not a contemplative order. Their vocation was the service of the church. Their vocation was to do what the Reformation had pointed out needed doing, and that was to clean up a corrupt church. So when you think of Ignatius Loyola, which is the name down here, the Jesuits are technically the Society of Jesus. Jesuit was a derogatory term the first time it was used. Many times, including Christian, were used first as a derogatory term and then was accepted as, yeah, that's what we are, Jesuit. But Society of Jesus is the technical name for it. And Ignatius Loyola is the person you think of. And the primary function you think of is the Counter-Reformation, meaning from within, it was an acknowledgement of some of the things that Luther and other reformers were saying, but it was done from within instead of from without. The fourth vow, only the Jesuits take, and that's special obedience to the Pope. The other vows do not have that. Okay. I hope that was helpful. It's very quick, but let's get on now to the question we started with. Yes?
Special obedience to the Pope. The other ones don't take the vow. They are not. Are they all Catholic?
Yes, sure.
Does being Catholic itself require obedience to the Pope?
Yes. I'm saying the Jesuits make that formal, like a public vow of celibacy, poverty, or obedience. The others do not add, and a kind of personal, vocational, direct obedience to the office of the Pope. The Jesuits have that built in from the start. As a formal part of who they are, it doesn't mean that they're saying that all Catholics do not acknowledge the Pope, and certainly members of the clergy and orders would in a stronger way than lay people. The Jesuits make that the most formal and the most emphatic of anybody. That's Mary.
Well, maybe I just have a misconception, but it seems to me that Jesuits are most active like in liberation theology situations, and seems to me in this day and age that maybe that is kind of in direct opposition many times to what the Pope is saying.
And the Pope just recently came down on them.
That's when you can really see that special obedience, because the Pope last year called the Jesuits to Rome and appointed a new head and really put his thumb of discipline on them. You rarely see that happening with the other orders. He doesn't call them.
And told Father Drinan to get out of Congress, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know enough history from my reading to answer your question, Mary, but if they were doing something that was contrary to the Pope's wishes, he has ways of stopping them different from any other persuasion or any other kind of ecclesiastical authority that he would have. And there are some very, very fine things the Jesuits have done. I'm by listing the differences between them and the other orders, I was not saying that they have not made some fine contributions. That's enough to tell you that in a technical way, John V. Taylor didn't mean orders. They are distinctive by taking solemn vows. And when he would say, what was the last thing he said in his quote, non-celibate, non-institutional, and secular, that's just not what orders were. Okay? Let me tell you what he could have said, which might have been more technically correct. There are two religious institutes. I love Roman Catholic. They have a title and a label for everything. Just wait a minute. Religious institutes. They are orders and congregations. You ought to know that what I'm putting on now is more my fascination than you necessarily needing to know to read Metz. I have to have a little of that, right? All right. Those are the religious institutes. Then there are secular institutes. And then there are pious societies. And there is one more. Let's see, what would be the... They even covered this. I've never heard of this one before. There are societies of the common life without vows. If you can't cover them with something else, then you just create a term. Of the two institutes, the religious institutes are obviously those who take vows and are oriented around clergy, worship, contemplation, and other things. Of the difference between orders and congregations, the orders take solemn vows and the congregations take simple vows. The ones that come under orders, we have pretty well covered, so a lot of the things that you think of as orders are not orders, but they are congregations. The Paulus, the Sisters of Notre Dame, all of those are congregations.
What's the difference between a solemn vow and a simple vow?
Spence, what's the difference between a solemn vow and a simple vow?
I mean, it's still hard to get out.
Right, I know. But there is a distinction. And the orders really stopped here, and the congregations didn't start till about the 15th century. They didn't use the term.
Did they come off of all these others?
They're very similar.
They're all branches of?
Yeah.
Because like the Trappists are not called an order, they're a congregation, or not?
It depends upon which book you're reading.
Yeah,
but
I
reading.
Don't really
want
to
know.
Yeah, all right.
I don't think that really doesn't matter.
Secular institutes, unlike this, are primarily in the world, doing work in the world, charitable work in the world, can be lay people with some clergy in it, but the very fact that it says secular, seculorum, worldly, it means it's the work of the church in the world. And then pious societies covers almost everything else. Sister Marie Augusta Neal explained it by saying those are groups that do not yet know what they're going to be. Okay? So probably most Lutherans are in pious societies, right? Or okay.
Can you give an example of the
Catholic Charities? Catholic Charities, sure. That would be, yeah.
Do they have vows and stuff too? Or
most of them do not have, no. I think when you talk about vows, you're talking about up here.
Okay.
As opposed to Catholic World Service or something like Lutheran World Relief would be a secular
Caritas.
Institute. Pardon?
Caritas. I don't know how to pronounce that in English.
Caritas.
Yeah, okay. All right. Who is studying Pustinia? Is Jean? Yeah. That she calls that a pious society. Madonna House. So tomorrow when we get to, aren't there ways in which you do church renewal without going into all of this stuff of being an order? There will be some examples of that. Yeah.
Okay.
Taizé is a Protestant, and then tomorrow and Wednesday we're going to say what? Is it an order, or does it better fit some other thing? Okay. Okay. Tomorrow, Rick's the expert on Taizé. We've got 9 experts tomorrow who are doing some extra reading. Okay. So the first... first response would be, no, Bishop Taylor used the wrong word. He means a new society, especially if he uses secular non-celibate, then it's not an order. I'm going to suggest that it does make sense to call it an order, that there are enough possibilities for that word meaning different things, and that we don't have to have all of the old freight. I was a pastor of a congregation and didn't have any hesitation using it, even though technically, by what we have on the board, I was the pastor of a religious society or something, or a local parish. In other words, I think the history is important, and the history is important when you read Metz, because you ought to know that when he says the religious life, he doesn't mean your ordinary going to church and saying your prayers. He means that the book is talking to superiors of orders. Religious life means members of religious orders. So you don't understand the book unless you understand some of the history of what's going on and who he's talking to. So the history is certainly important at that point. Now I'm going to give you what I think, after distilling a lot of stuff, is the essential quality of what we're talking about if we use order. The reason that I think Taylor has good reason for choosing the order. Reversal of worldly values. I want to substantiate that a little bit with some quotes and then have discussion. If I can get my notes. First of all, Martin Luther on orders. I believe that it is better to be a monk now than it has been in the past 200 years for this reason. Up until now, monks have shrunk back from the cross and it has been an honorable thing to be a monk. Now, however, they are again beginning to incur men's displeasure. For that is what being a monk means, to be hated by the world and to appear foolish in its sight. Does that connect with anything in Metz? You will be neither a fool nor a rebel, but will be mistaken for both. That's what Metz is talking about. He's calling orders back into their original, essential function, and that's to be a protest movement when the church itself has become enculturated or over-adapted to the society of the world around you. That's what we're talking about primarily. Kierkegaard. 19th century fight against identification of Protestantism with bourgeois respectability. What did he say? A return to the monastery from which Luther broke out. You have to remember, Luther was an Augustinian monk. You don't understand the Reformation unless you understand the context of Luther being a monk. A return to the monastery from which Luther broke out. That is what Christianity has to achieve. First of all, Kierkegaard called for the kind of thing that Bishop Taylor calls for, and said that knowing what he was saying. Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, a Cistercian. I say it is a good sort of playing by which we become an object of reproach to the rich and of ridicule to the proud. In fact, what else do seculars think we're doing but playing when what they desire most on earth we fly from, and what they fly from we desire? A reversal of worldly values is the clearest way to understand function of monk. Thomas Merton, last speech he gave, last paper he read, Bangkok, 1968, with wet feet plugged in a fan and electrocuted within an hour after he said it. The monk is essentially someone who takes up a critical attitude toward the world and its structures. That's the essence. In Catholic language, the others are accidents. Male, celibate, cloistered, vows, accident. That doesn't mean unimportant. It means not the essence. The essence is someone who takes up a critical attitude toward the world and its structures. I want to give you that in another form. Matthew Kelty, Trappist. Another way of saying that is Order of Cistercians of the Strict Observance. Abbey of Gethsemane, Trappist Monastery in Kentucky, same one Merton was in. Just love the introduction to an article called Life in the Desert. It would seem that we have come full circle. The religious life which began in the desert is back there once again. Having over the centuries moved slowly out of the sands and up to the northern islands by sea, and then from below into the wilderness of Europe, it moved also gingerly at first and much later more bravely out into the world itself until today, when some of it mingles quite at home in the midst of it. Meanwhile, something else has been happening, and that especially in our time. The world has become a desert. There are not a few who have noted this character of the contemporary scene, and it requires no great imagination to see that there is truth in it. In more ways than one, the world we know is falling apart. We witness the disintegration of a way of life that enters into almost every aspect of it. No one has the vaguest idea what will eventually emerge of anything at all, for it is too much too soon for that. What we share in the breakdown and collapse of a culture, not yet its rebuilding, measure the total impact of this century, horrendous wars, weakening of family life, failure in education, disenchantment with the acquisitive society, pointlessness of much human labor, the ruin of natural resources, the fall of the idol science, the threat of annihilation of the whole world at the hands of human beings, the loss of spirit, of faith, of God. These are the factors that brought man today into a true desert. And if you have some grasp of the basic monastic experience, the desert experience, the expected will now follow. An overwhelming despair, a loss of faith, and a demonic vision. I think Metz is saying the same thing. He characterizes society as when the mystery of the love between two people has died, and this whole attitude of despair, that when we live now, we live in a desert, not in the sand, but the life, the world itself is a desert. Now, Kelty's premise. Everyone then is called to be a monk today. Everyone undergoes the desert experience, whether you like it or not. It isn't that you choose to go out into the desert. This is where we're living. Now what? The call is now a general call, and Western world is undergoing a deep spiritual experience, and so far not doing so well. In this situation, an ironic note enters, for now the monk is to enter the world, not to leave it. Today, if he seeks to isolate and insulate himself from the world situation, he's not really a good monk. The tables have turned. Everything is now the other way around. If anything is needed in this hour, it is people who know their way around a desert. People who can understand what's going on and can interpret it, can manage with it. Everyone is looking for such people, and sad to say, not finding too many. It becomes clear now that the monks have not been in the desert. He's doing the same thing Metz is doing. He's calling for the monks who know how to live in the desert to come forth and help us all live, because that's where we now are. And the fact that there's not much help means the monks have not really been in the desert. Okay. He's saying it more poetically, but in some ways more exciting. Metz is a German theologian. This guy's a poet. Okay. So if the world is under judgment, and it is, so are we. It is a good time. It's refreshing, stimulating, challenging, difficult. Finding solitude today is no problem. Most everyone experiences great loneliness and the anguish of being a solitary in a disintegrating world. There is no problem trying to stimulate desire for genuine community. How many there are who are hungry for that, yearn it more than anything else. To be a monk at this time then is really to be a person of the hour. No person in the church is more necessary or more useful. The desert is the monk's world, and today the world is a desert. I mean monk in the widest sense, men and women in contemplative orders, but also any Christian called in grace by circumstance, by temperament, by character, or by accident to enter deeply into the mystery of this era with Christ and to unite with Christ there in the desert. That's a very, very good introduction to what we're doing and to Metz's book. It was in Catalogite, the journal of Southern churchmen, Will Campbell. You find the greatest stuff in that, and I cut it out years ago, fall 1975, stuck it in a file called Orders. Yeah, sure. Except our copier, our technology at Holden is always letting us down, and it isn't working this morning, but we'll, okay. Therefore, if the essence is a reversal of worldly values, the question for all three of the times together, now we're finally getting to it, is this. Was or is Protestantism poorer for suppressing monasticism, which we certainly have done.
Why do you say we've suppressed it?
I'm glad you asked that. Just a minute. The question today is a historic summary so that you understand it a little bit, and especially something like the Kelty article or the Metz book, giving you a deep appreciation for it. Tomorrow, we're going to argue against it and say, no, the last thing you want is the orders. We can do that, and we can do it in Protestant freedom without going back to orders. I hope you sense the debate tomorrow. But the question, both day, all 3 days, is, are we poor for having suppressed it? Now, let me... Pardon? Aren't there Protestant orders as well? Rick will say Taizé is... Grand Champ, certainly the sisters in Switzerland are, but it's very rare, and it's kind of recent, not to suppress it. Let me read Adolf von Harnack. The Reformation abolished monasticism. It was bound to abolish it. It rightly affirmed that to take a vow of lifelong asceticism, as the experience of monastic vows, obedience to a superior, and the promotion of poverty, almost to the point of not giving thanks for every good and perfect gift. Luther's angst and despair that came from that heavy Augustinian emphasis on judgment. I mean, if Luther left the monastery, married, brought hymns in, gave the laity a Bible in their own language, you know that part of that would also be to rebel against that, where that system that he had to be freed from to find the joy of justification by faith. I mean, it's almost inevitable that a movement that had to leave something and stand as its critic would also reject it and suppress it. And it did. Monasteries in those countries of Europe just about went out of existence after the Reformation. It rightly affirmed that to take a vow of lifelong asceticism was a piece of presumption. It rightly considered that any worldly vocation, conscientiously followed in the sight of God, was equal to, nay, better than, being a monk. But something now happened which Luther neither foresaw nor desired. Monasticism of the kind that is conceivable and necessary in the evangelical sense of the word disappeared altogether. But every community stands in need of personalities living exclusively for its own ends, for its ends, the community's ends. The church, for instance, needs volunteers who will abandon every other pursuit and renounce the world and devote themselves entirely to the service of their neighbor. Not because such a vocation is a higher one, but because it is a necessary one. Because no church can live without giving rise to the desire of being this contagious lead. But in the evangelical churches, the desire has been checked by the decided attitude they have been compelled to adopt toward Catholicism. It is a high price that we've paid, nor can the price be reduced by considering, on the other hand, how much simple and unaffected religious fervor has been kindled in home and family life. Now the quote, Protestantism was the poorer for suppressing monasticism. That's the question. Is it or is it not poorer for having suppressed monasticism? So where are we? We're at the end of our time. We have the essence, we have the question. What we're going to start with tomorrow, I'll put it on the board for you today and we'll end with that. But what we're going to start with tomorrow is a somewhat arbitrary list of what we mean when we say order. And if you're taking notes, put these down so that we can assume that this is our list for tomorrow. I think it's okay as a working list. Six characteristics, and this is what we're going to mean when we say orders. A protest movement. Now you can find other ways to say that. You can say a reversal of worldly values. Counterculture, but in some ways a protest movement. It has a rule, has a standard that you can bounce up against that has been agreed to as the norm. It has a specific statement of faith, however you want to say that. Takes vows. We won't worry about solemn or simple. It makes commitments called vows. It has a particular focus. Dominican Order of Preachers, Franciscan, keep the idea of poverty. Jesuits, Counter-Reformation. Can you think of distinctive? In Metz, it isn't a crisis of vocation, it's a crisis of function, because the orders have lost their distinctive task. All right. I haven't checked with you today. Are there people that are just unable to read Metz? Or I see people nodding when I go back and give particular quotes, but he's hard to read. We're going to spend time both tomorrow and Wednesday with what I did today, not with a book study. But I'm hoping you get to the point where things like neither fools nor rebels but mistaken for both come out. And I think they will more after we've talked about orders, but we'll have to check that more tomorrow. A particular focus. Linked with others. When there was one religious house, when there was one community, it was simply that. It was when there were other houses that were linked under the same rule and the same vow that an order started. That's a distinctive part of it. That's the way in which the Jesuits are the most order, because they have the most esprit de corps no matter where they are in the world. The link is the strongest. Do you see? And finally, accountable to the church. This is my list. This is not the right answer from some book. So you can test the list as we're going. Now, why have that list? The question tomorrow is, yes, we want church renewal. The orders had some good points to them, but there's a better way to do it, and Protestantism has a way in which you are freed from all of this heavy stuff. Let's do it with communities. Let's do it with a movement that doesn't have to ask anybody or have all of this falderal with it. Let's form a society that has simple life as our function. Why go into orders? When we examine, do those things have these criteria, they will not have this same set. A community does not have all these six aspects. A movement is missing some of these aspects. Then we will ask, is there an advantage for church renewal that the orders have that these freer movements do not have? Do you get the question? And there are good arguments on both sides. I'm not setting you up. In fact, our inclination will be against orders. So I may push, do you realize what you're missing there? By not having that characteristic, you're missing some point of either renewal or mutual support or commitment or, okay. Tomorrow, there are also 9 people who have done some reading in regard to community life, examples of movements, societies, more Protestant disciplines. Celebration of Discipline, Foster's book, is a fine book. Dan Erlander's done some research where Luther called for what looks like a more free church movement and may well be calling for orders within the Lutheran Church from Luther's works on worship. So we'll have a general discussion based on today, but also 9 people have prepared in a way that you were not all expected to prepare. The other ingredient tomorrow is I hope today, after today, you'll have some time to read again at least the theses and the questions, and if one of the theses interests you, for instance, I think at least the way it's stated, thesis 10 on page 91, I just think is very well said. In a society whose public concern is too exclusively characterized by the sense of possession, and which therefore tends to make a matter of social indifference everything that has no market value, Christianity has either a radical or a lamentable existence. I think that's just right on. If that interests you, that's expanded on a full page back in the first part. You're getting the distillation at the end, and if something triggers you, go back to that. The point is not to have a full comprehension of everything that Met says. It's to let those kinds of...